Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. My guests today are Jim Stringer and Mark Quinn, the authors of a fascinating new book about the history of Rochdale Hornets, titled Triumph and Disaster, 150 Years of Rochdale Hornets. Hornets are one of the earliest rugby clubs to be formed in the north of England, and last year they celebrated their 150th anniversary. This year, 2022, is also the centenary of the first and only time the club won the Rugby League Challenge Cup. As Jim and Mark make clear in the book, much of Hornets' history has been a struggle against the odds, yet the club continues to survive. In many ways, it's an exemplar of the struggles that rugby league as a whole has faced over the past century. It's a book rich in detail and full of love for the club and the game. This shouldn't be surprising, as both Jim and Mark are lifelong fans who have long been involved in the running of Hornets. So the book also has something of an insider's perspective on the last 30 years, especially the period when the club was run as a supporters cooperative. So, welcome to the show, Jim and Mark.
Hello.
I kind of think we should start, although you cover 100 years, I'm going to ask you about the period before 100 years, before the 150 years, because Rochdale was probably one of the earliest football towns, certainly in Lancashire. And as many people who are interested in the history of football will know, two Rochdale teams, Bodyguard and Fear Not, actually played each other in 1841, one of the earliest organised club matches of football. So the club's obviously got a very long history of football in all its forms.
That's right, Tony. Rochdale as a town is a bit of a strange one because it was quite an early adopter of football, even before it was codified. A local historian, Henry Fishwick, wrote in the middle of the 19th century that mob football was played in the town as early as 1775. And it was played, two sets of local villagers would come into the town centre, attempt to cart a pig's bladder across the town centre. Reports of those games do indicate that quite a few of the games ended up in the river. But as you know, Tony, sort of mob football was ended by a change to the Highways Act, which forbade the playing of football in the street. So by the time the Bodyguard Club and the Fear Nots met each other in 1841, they'd been forced into being codified, really, due to the ban on mob football. It was 12 aside, the Fear Nots versus the Bodyguards. It was played on Christmas Day, 1841. It was played to local rules. What is interesting is that in order to score, both teams had to try and kick the ball over the fence at their opponent's end of the ground. The game was eventually won on a technicality after a Bodyguards player brought a member of the crowd onto the field to take a kick because he was too tired to kick it.
Well, an early example of community involvement in a club, I would have thought. Mark, but Hornets weren't the first Rochdale club, were they? There was a club formed in the 1860s.
Well, I think there was, a mixed match sort of group of teams that all came together. You know, there was, I think, one of the most envious statistics I think we dug up, there was something like 88 teams based in Rochdale, you know, in the early or the late 1800s. So you think that is just, you would give any rugby league or any rugby club would give their right arm to have that sort of level of support. And it was the better of those teams could see that to compete with, you know, the major teams that were emerging at the time, Rochdale teams needed to come together. And in effect, we were an early merger, which probably would be a bit more controversial if it happened now.
Yeah, and I suppose partially what was going on then, because it was the early days of rugby in Lancashire and the north of England, Hornets were the town team, weren't they? They were the representative of Rochdale as a town when they were playing the other clubs in Lancashire, Yorkshire, and also Wales and the south as well. So the club very quickly became a focus for community support.
And I think the best players inevitably gravitated to Hornets. Everybody, you know, any aspirational sportsman wants to play for the best team against the best opponents. And playing for Rochdale Hornets in the 1870s gave you that opportunity to get. Even then, there were superstars, you know, in the midst of the game. And Rochdale Hornets' first captain was a chap called Osborne, who was the fullback for England in the first ever rugby international. So there were people emerging that were stars of the day. You know, and you see those cigarette card type advertisements for players, and you want to be that that chap, don't you? You know, you want to represent your town playing with these superstars, you know, pre-TV days and stuff. So, yeah, I think that was the lure to get the best players to turn out.
Jim, there was I think one of the interesting things you've got in the book is that you almost track the way in which the club went from being, like all the rugby clubs in the early 1870s, very much a club of the elite of the town, of the privately educated, the grammar school educated, to becoming the club for the whole of the town. And you've got stuff in there about how working class players came into the club, and that meant that Hornets were quite enthusiastic supporters of the Northern Union when it was formed.
They were. Hornets were very, very strong advocates of compensating players for broken time. And certainly for a good couple of years before the split in 1895, Hornets had been paying their players to compensate them for wages lost. At the time, the president, James Hartley, whilst he was an advocate of paying players to compensate them for wages lost, he was still an opponent of paying players to play football. So he believed that it was a working rights matter to compensate people for the time lost. And certainly a player called Ned Wilde at the time confirmed that he was compensated for his wages when he played. And that was around the 1870s, 1880s.
And also, it looks like there was no real opposition to joining the Northern Union. I mean, some clubs, and particularly sort of the more patrician clubs, hesitated. But Hornets, from what you've got in the book, were fairly full on in terms of their support for forming the Northern Union, weren't they?
I think it's worth, you know, in that time, Rochdale would be one of the wealthiest towns in the world. So even the working classes would be relatively affluent. And so they were, you know, a level of aspiration. And, you know, if you ever come to Rochdale and look at the town hall, which is the most fantastic building, it was built in 1871 or finished in 1871, the same year as Hornets was launched. So I think that plays, you know, that sort of emerging, not quite middle class, but emerging upper working class. I think that played a part in it, in that these people were, you know, could make their own minds up. They weren't from that downtrodden sort of lower working class sort of ethos. And I think that's helped the emergence at Rochdale of backing the new Northern Union.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an important point as well, that that people often forget that for a lot of the towns that were involved in the Northern Union, in a sense, that they were at the 1890s were at the point where they're at their strongest economically. They were vibrant socially and culturally, and the Northern Union was formed at that point. But for a lot of towns, mining towns, but particularly textile towns, that economic buoyancy had deserted them by the time you get to the end of World War One. So I think that's an important point to bear in mind about the self-confidence that the Northern Union had. It came from how strong these towns were, didn't it?
It was, and I think it reflects that confidence that the northern counties wanted self-determination to arrange league and cup games amongst themselves to make, you know, make the game more attractive and guarantee more revenue. And I think it came off the back of, you know, an industrialist commercial mindset that to create something attractive and engaging would draw people to it and create revenue. And Hornets, as Mark said, you know, from the outset, they wanted bigger games against the best opposition to make it more attractive. You know, they wanted to build something substantive and move away from just local football.
And I think the other way that's reflected, I think, and again, you bring it out really well in the book, is the way in which the board of directors or the committee of Hornets in that immediate sort of 20 years after the Northern Union split were very outward-looking, very advanced. So there's huge numbers of players that are recruited from Devon and from Somerset, including Walter Roman, who went on the 1914 tour and then died in World War One. So the club directors, they were very, very much in a sense expansionary and forward looking in a way that not a lot of clubs were at that time.
Well, the book is a mystery why they tapped the Southwest, and maybe that it was you know, to use another mining euphemism, that South Wales had been mined out, you know, in that time. And then they look further afield. And the South West has always been a strong rugby hotbed, if you will. And, you know, we picked up, in effect, the dominant accent in the Hornets dressing room in 1922 would be Southwest Devon accent, not a Northern Rochdale accent by any means. And I think that maybe it was just they could get them cheap. And you know, they were quite astute in that.
And I think it was a bit of a two-way street as well. You know, they were picking up good quality players. They were picking up players who'd played top-grade football in the Southwest, in South Wales, guys who played county-level football, guys who played international-level football. And when you're at that level of your sporting career, where do you go next? And obviously, the lure of being paid to play in a growing competition that had big crowds and had an opportunity to win more things, you know, was a big draw, I think. And it was also a little bit, you know, when one player comes, others follow. Hornets signed Tommy Woods, and not long afterwards, they signed Walter Roman, who played with Tommy Woods at Bridgewater. So the joining players that they know, and that happened in the South West and in Wales.
And I think one of the great what-ifs of Hornets history, or rugby league history, is that, and again, as you make clear in the book, that on the back of those signings, those innovative signings from the South West, the club actually becomes quite successful in the years before the First World War, winning the Lancashire Cup. And then in the years immediately after the First World War, they're also successful as well, as we mentioned right at the top of the show, winning the Challenge Cup in 1922. So you wonder whether, if it hadn't been for World War One, whether Hornets would have established themselves as actually one of the top clubs in the competition.
Well, I think that's almost the narrative through the book of what if you know, if circumstances hadn't been as they were, like I said, the First World War arriving, in reality, not making the Challenge Cup in its Wembley era and losing in two semi-finals. Both myself and Jim, you know, we're of the mind that played a huge detrimental impact on the club, and it could have absolutely changed their course of direction. And going back to the point, yeah, you know, the First World War arrived rather badly timed for Hornets, well, for the world really, but for Hornets were the ones who suffered, I think.
I think it was exacerbated as well, as I think you mentioned earlier, Tony, in the sort of back end of the 20s and early 30s, cotton collapsed, and Rochdale, as a town, had banked its entire economy on King Cotton, as it was. All the towns in the Northwest were either spinners of yarn or weavers of cloth, and Rochdale was both. They were, to use an economics term, Mark, they were vertically integrated. So the whole of the town's economy was basically locked into cotton production. And when cotton production slumped, the local economy slumped, and that took the club kind of with it, really. At the time, the population of the town was 90,000. We had 4,500 people unemployed and 24,000 people on short time. So that's almost like half of your working population is suffering because, you know, the cotton trade was then moving to Japan. And it became a cycle that unemployment meant that crowds diminished. Crowds diminishing meant that revenue falls. Revenue falls means that performance suffers. Performance suffering means that crowds diminish. But higher unemployment also means you can't find jobs for good quality players. So your performance suffers, which means that crowds diminish, which means revenues go down. And ultimately, there was almost a 10-year spiral that was almost impossible to stop as cotton waned and the economy struggled to rebalance itself in the wake of that.
Yeah, so in a sense then, so Hornets were at the strongest in the 1890s, 1900s, and then their fate was very much tied to the cotton industry. It was strong before the First World War, and then it went into what turned out to be terminal decline in the 1920s. And the clubs, as with the town, unfortunately, the club has never got over that. However, having said that, I think one of the things, again, that's really interesting about the book is that the attempts that the leadership of the club made in the 40s and 50s to break that cycle through the recruitment of players from, to some extent, from unusual places. And we'll get on to Fiji in a moment. But certainly, the Hornets were I think it was 1947, there was a ban on British rugby league clubs importing Australians. And so Hornets were the first club to try and get around the ban by signing Australian rugby union players who had actually started off as rugby league players. And that, again, it kind of speaks to the innovation, if you like, or if you like the sneakiness from another perspective, of the club and the club's officials who are actually trying to do something to rescue the club.
It does go back to that in the 19, you know, the just around the First World War time, signing those players from the Southwest. In the 30s, they signed Victor Armbruster, who is regarded in the top 100 kangaroos of all time. So it's the equivalent Hornets now signing Cameron Smith, or, you know, a player of that, you know, John Thurston or something like that. That they were signing players like that. Was a big money signing. But then into the 40s of, you know, Wally MacArthur, and you know, that we'll touch on that, and, you know, signing an Italian rugby union player who came. And his first, this I find incredible, his first game was the semi-final of the Challenge Cup. So he came over having never played rugby league, and they put him in the side. He scored, but you couldn't even dream of doing that, you know, giving somebody a chance like that. And I think maybe there's an element of that they did appreciate there's showbiz in it. You know, you want to get people through the gate, so you need the characters. And I think that's maybe where that was the driver. Of getting bums on seats rather than building a strong team.
One of the star players for Hornets in the 50s that kind of exemplified that attitude of the club of trying to go out and find star power was Wally MacArthur, the Aboriginal Australian winger who came over in, I think, 1953. And that's quite a story in itself, isn't it?
It is, you know, to sign one of the world's foremost Olympic standard sprinters, and bring him all the way around the world on the pretense of doing an engineering apprenticeship, because obviously Hornets were already on the radar of the Australian Board of Control. So they brought him in for educational reasons. And then within a week of him landing, he sort of said, well, you know, I fancy a few games with Rochdale Hornets while I'm here, and that might get in the way of my engineering apprenticeship. But MacArthur was box office. If you look at the crowd figures, when he arrived, the crowd figures went up significantly. While he played with us, they peaked at the highest level in the 50s. And when he left, the crowd figures went down again. You know, so he was absolute box office. But like many players who were brought on a promise, he was let down quite badly by the club. They promised that once he was settled here, he could bring his wife over. And then when his wife came over, he asked for accommodation for himself and his wife, not just for himself. And the club virtually denied all knowledge of ever having made that offer. He became disgruntled, as you would, being a young lad on the other side of the world with only your wife for company. He became disgruntled, and the club saw him as trouble, inverted commas. And then the rift was almost, you know, a breaking point, really. He was frustrated and unhappy with his lot. Hornets saw him as just, you know, too much trouble to countenance, and clearly he moved away from the club, which was, it doesn't reflect particularly well on the club, and I think it sours the story once you read into, you know, the way he was treated. It does sour what was a fantastic story.
Yeah, I mean, that's my reason as well, that he was badly done by, and there was, you know, you get a sense when people start talking about him being a troublemaker, there was sorts of racial stereotypes creeping in there. But on the other hand, the club has this amazing record and reputation of being a colony of Fiji in the north of England due to its incredible signings of Fijian players in the early 1960s. Mark, so what's the background to that? How did Rochdale become home to so many Fijians?
Well, I think there's as with a lot of things, there's a little bit of mystery in this, because it was Rochdale law that Arthur Walker was in Australia, and he watched with the Great Britain Rugby League team, and he watched the Fijians play Australia in rugby union. And that was given as a fact until Jim decided to try and figure out which actual match it was that Arthur Walker went to. And the Fijians were never in Australia at the time the Brits were there. Jim has managed to figure out, and he'll probably touch on it, which match, there's a faint possibility Arthur Walker saw the Fijians playing. But it was just again, I think it was looking outside the box. It was a cheaper alternative than shipping up somebody from South Wales. And again, it was box office. It was these absolutely sort of glamorous and from the other side of the world, a place nobody had, you know, people hadn't gone to Spain at the time, never mind to Fiji, had never, you know, sort of only faintly heard of it. You know, you might see it in a Bob Hope movie or somewhere. But you had these men, and they were giants, you know, physical big men coming to Rochdale. And I think there was an element of show and an element of you can get these guys relatively cheap. So I think Jim will fill you in on the mystery of the match.
the myth was always that, as Mark said, that Hornets chairman Arthur Walker had seen them play the Wallabies at Rugby Union. But Great Britain were never in Australia at the time when they met in Sydney. So that negated him ever seeing the Wallabies play Fiji in Sydney. The only likely possibility is that Arthur Walker was with the Great Britain team on the way back from the 1957 World Cup. And he stopped off, the squad stopped off in New Zealand to play a couple of games against the Kiwis. And in that same month, the Fijian Rugby Union team were touring New Zealand. So that puts Arthur Walker, the Great Britain side, and Fiji in the same on the same island at the same time. So that's much more likely than any other scenario. And what's really, really interesting is that the two players who came over, who were Orissi Dewai and Joe Lavula, were both playing in those games in New Zealand at the time. So that seems the most likely scenario.
One of the most amazing things about the Fijian story is that they may have come over because it was a chance to make money from their rugby skills that they couldn't under Rugby Union. But the fact they were taken to their hearts by the Rochdale community and they actually stayed in Rochdale and in many ways formed a Fijian community in Rochdale and a rugby dynasty. I mean, what's the story behind that?
What you'd also got in parallel was Fijians could leave Fiji. They hadn't been allowed to leave permanently. They could go to university, but they had to come home. And that was the paramount chief of Fiji. And he passed away. And that would open up, not say the floodgates, but certainly opened up a small bandwidth for Fijians to leave. And predominantly, they joined the British Army. So there was 214 Fijians joined the British Army. So when they were on leave, a lot of them were based at Catterick Garrick. So when they were there, missing home, they would come to the nearest thing they had, which was Rochdale. So they would come and meet the Fijians, the early pioneers who had, you know, grown, and Lavula had joined, and people like this. So there was like a little community. And so a lot of them would come and stay. They may not be good enough to play for Hornets, but they would play in like for local teams. At Rugby Union a lot of the times, but certainly Rugby League. And then they stayed and they married locally and one became two, became four. It's such a fantastic story that culminated into a lot of degrees in 2013 and us hosting Fiji in the World Cup, which was just the most amazing evening.
But I think it was it was to the credit of Rochdale as a town in the 60s, you know. I know we've had this conversation previously, Tony, but, you know, there weren't many Lancashire mill towns with 6'6" Fijian guys walking around them in the early 60s. I think they weren't considered a freak show. They were considered as stars. You know, these guys had come all the way around the world to play rugby for Rochdale Hornets. You know, and they were absolutely adored by the locals. And they did work very hard in building relationships. They had a musical group called the South Sea Serenaders that would play the local working men's clubs and the pubs. And you know, doing those gigs around the town raised their profile and got people interested in where they came from and what their culture was. And there was a bit of exchange of culture there, you know, five Fijian guys singing South Sea songs with guitars in Lancashire pubs. You know, it's a fairly interesting cultural confluence, isn't it?
That community is still there today, isn't it? And sadly, Mike Ratu, one of the great names in that community, died just recently as well.
His son, Michael had two sons, and one of them was Michael and the other one was Emin. Emin helped with the book, with the Fijian chapter, and interviewed his dad, which features quite heavily in the book. His grandson, Michael Jr. in effect, played for Hornets when we beat Toulouse in 2016. So that lineage and the decision by Arthur Walker to ship in some Fijians, you know, back in the early 60s, meant that we had a Fijian who was strong enough and powerful enough to hold off a couple of defenders to feed the winger for two tries. So, you know, thank God for Arthur Walker back in 1961.
That leads me on to another story about the internationalism of Hornets and Arthur Walker. It was the 1963 Kangaroo Tour when Hornets played Australia. That there was a, shall we say, a an unusual background to the match, wasn't there?
There was. Arthur Walker had a bit of a showman streak to him, and the Australians in time gave him the opportunity to do something eye-catching. So arranged a civic reception for them at Rochdale Town Hall. And during that reception, he made it clear to their management that they were going to walk in a parade to the ground for the game, not telling them it was 2 miles away up Rochdale's steepest street. So after they'd fed them for 2 hours, they joined this parade, which was led by Arthur Walker's grandson riding a donkey and followed by a big gang of local kids and a brass band. So they marched them for a mile up Rochdale's steepest street. And when they got to the top of Drake Street in Rochdale, instead of carrying on to the ground, they took a sharp left to the ambulance drill hall, where there's a huge children's costume party happening, where they then got the Australian team to judge the fancy dress party. Having delayed them for half an hour judging a fancy dress party, they then resumed the last mile walk to the ground behind the donkey, which was called Jacko the Donkey, by the way. The Australians narrowly beat Rochdale Hornets. And in the post-match interview, the Australian manager said, well, it's no wonder because you walked the bloody legs off us before the game. At the post-match reception, there was a raffle. And the Australian journalist that was accompanying the Australian team won the raffle, not knowing that his prize was the donkey. And when he said to Arthur Walker, what am I going to do with a donkey? Can't do the accent. What am I going to do with a donkey? Walker said to him, well, you can ride it or you could eat it. As it was, he did neither, and he donated it to a local children's home.
Yeah, that would have been a great Aussie team as well, wouldn't it? The Gasnier, Raper, and all the rest of them who beat England, Great Britain, 50 points to whatever at Swinton that time. Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why they should bring back tours.
Every tour should start with a donkey parade.
It's it gives a different aspect to the game, doesn't it? I think it would be great.
Well, we actually brought it back in 2013. We had a match to the match.
Oh, really? For the Fiji match?
Yeah. So we'd the Fijians didn't walk in the parade. It was we collated the bid and we got invited along to several World Cup meetings, and he said, did anybody have any innovative marketing strategies? So I submitted the match to the match, and we did it, and I think Whitehaven did it as well. Obviously you need a route that's safe that you can get to, but it's such a good idea, you know, meet at a local pub and all walk to the game. And I think it harks back to what people used to do, you know, they would meet somewhere and then literally march to the match, and you know, we'll bring that back again.
So after the kind of heyday of the Fijians, as with the game as a whole, from in the 70s and 80s, things got gradually worse, certainly economically, for the club. And by the time we get to the 1980s, the impact of the Bradford City fire, the terrible tragedy at Bradford that led to the wholesale rethinking about the standards that grounds had, that almost did for the club, didn't it? As it did for a lot of other clubs. But for Hornets, it was particularly grievous.
I think there was that, you know, those three tragedies of, you know, Heysel, Hillsborough and Bradford fire impacted so, you know, enormously on ground safety. So ground capacities were slashed. And, you know, when you look at something, I'll say, like Oddsall, and my mum and dad went to that particular game when, you know, over 100,000 there. And it would be like, you know, 10,000 tops at some time. And that impacts on your revenue generation, but also the costs, which, you know, sometimes supporters don't see, of stewarding. You have to have so many stewards per exit and number of attendees. And it just made life beyond bearable. For a lot of clubs and Hornets and people like Swinton, Oldham, Hull KR to a degree, all ended up selling their grounds. And I think that's been a difficult road to come back from.
Yeah, but the club has. I mean, I think that's one of the interesting things, that despite all the problems, that it's throughout the 80s and 90s, it actually did more than cling on to life. It actually avoided the fate of, you know, the fate that could have engulfed it, and it succeeded. What's your opinion of how the club was able to survive that, despite the fact it obviously didn't have that, you know, great record of success when it came to competitions? Nevertheless, it was still strong at its roots.
I think Jim will say exactly the same answer as me. He was £2.7 million worth of cash from Morrison Supermarket that allowed us to sort of continue. And you know, and be big time Charlies for a time, you know, and signing players and living the dream.
For the first time in our history, we were the cash richest club, probably in World Rugby League. You know, we had £2.5 million cash sat in the bank at one point. And not many other clubs could lay a claim to that, I don't think. But when you break down the way in which the cash was spent, it was never destined to last over the long term. There was lots of enforced investments made out of that. A large amount of money was required to build a community centre next door to the supermarket that was built on site of the old ground. A lot of investment went into buying a 47.5% share of the Spotland Stadium Company. Some of the money was used to build new stands at Spotland. So by the end of all that expenditure, the club probably had somewhere in the region of £1 million, £900,000 left in the bank. And if it costs 100 last in 10 years, isn't it, at best? So, but as Mark said, they got a bit giddy, I think, didn't they, Mark?
Well, the one that stands out, we signed Ian Goose Gormley. And back in the day, if the two teams couldn't agree a transfer fee, then it would go to the tribunal. And I think, as Jim's touched on, Hornets were looked on as this cash cow. And we signed Ian Goose Gormley, who had a worse disciplinary record, I think, than Jim Mills. And the tribunal said £90,000 for a non-international. a decent player, don't get me wrong, but not sort of world-class by any stretch. And we were shelling out money left, right and centre, building a team of not bad players. It was a decent side, probably one of the best Hornets I've had since the 60s. But was just a drain. And we lived that dream. We got promoted, but soon came back down.
It did work in the long term. When you're a big fish in a small pond like we were, you know, in that second division then, you know, we did have a lot of spending power that other clubs didn't have. So it was relatively straightforward getting out of that division, but very hard to sustain when you're facing Wigan, St Helens, Castleford every week, you know, big teams with sort of lots of experience, bigger budgets, great international players. We really, really struggled.
But by the time you get to the 2000s and the late 2000s, the club takes the decision, or rather, well, the community of the club takes the decision to form a supporters cooperative to run the club, which, again, I suppose going back to the traditions of the club and the town, is an incredibly radical step to take. It's not something that most professional clubs undertake. I mean, I think there's one or two football clubs. And so Hornets were very much the pioneers in that. What was the thinking behind going down the cooperative route, and how did it work out?
Well, it wasn't really our thinking. The club had gone bump, it had gone into administration, and it was an idea from the RFL to try and save Hornets. You know, and there was phone calls, was there a group of supporters willing to take on the club? Jim at the time ran something called the Nest Egg, which was the nearest thing we had to a supporters association. It was just a loose fundraising group, really. And, you know, to paraphrase, I think it was Malcolm X, Plymouth Rock, we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
Yeah.
we sort of woke up one morning and here you go, guys, you've got a rugby league club. And again, it wasn't as straightforward as that. It, like I say, it was an RFL initiative. but they didn't really have faith in us just to take it and run with it. And they brought in a management consultancy company to run it for us. And it was a shambles. The company they brought in was called Sponsor Bank. By the end of the season, they'd gone bankrupt. Hornets that season lost £180,000. And that's what we inherited. A club that had a debt of 180 grand. Everybody bailed at that point. You know, the RFL weren't as keen on it as they once were. It was a tarnished thing. But we had to sort of rally the troops, circle the wagons is another euphemism, and sort of crack on and, you know, do what we could do. And we did all right.
This latter part of the book, when you talk about what happened with in the run-up to the formation of the cooperative and the cooperative, I think is actually one of the most fascinating parts of the book. And I say this, obviously, as a historian, I'm really interested in things that happened 100-odd years ago, but it's that more recent stuff that I think you've captured really well. And again, in a lot of ways, it kind of encapsulates a lot of the problems facing the game as a whole. And also some of the, shall we say, questionable decision-making by those in a higher authority. As you point out, the business guru that you were recommended himself went bust long before the club ever did. The other thing that's interesting is the fact that the club is no longer a supporters cooperative. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that, because the supporters cooperative, again, particularly in football, is held up as being the model of the way that football clubs should be run. But it's clear in the case of Hornets, it didn't actually match what the club wanted ultimately, did it?
I think it's quite a complex question, really. Because it wasn't an evolution that, you know, the supporters, Loose Supporters organisation became a trust and then lobbied to take over the club. There was never the sort of will of the people, if you will, for this system. And everybody looks to a big investor to come in and buy the star players. And it was always thought that a group of supporters couldn't be competitive. We would never get to Super League. And that was always the dream, that if we could bring in a new investor, that we could, get to Super League if Elon Musk came along and decided he fancied Rochdale Hornets. Partly as well, we're a club that's been heavily factionalised over the years, with different groups and different interest lobbies, if you will. And it was when, you know, literally, although it's going to seem slightly boastful, when I was in charge and we were successful, those voices off were quiet. I stepped down and then all of a sudden, you know, naively, I assumed that somebody else would come forward, but there wasn't. There was this sort of power struggle that sort of ended up pretty much tearing the club apart, you know. And I'm not talking two factions at each other. There was several factions scrapping, and it wasn't pretty. And inevitably, the only escape was to sort of everybody had to step aside and get a new person in, which is where the Andy Maisie consortium came along.
And that was also compounded by the fact that, you know, if you are supporter owned and you're Barcelona, you've got 500,000 people chucking you €100 a week, which is great. If you're supporter owned and you're Rochdale Hornets, on an average crowd of 450 or 500, of which only 175 people are paid up members, and of which only 50% contribute more than their membership fee, you know, it ceases to be viable. And it's not sustainable. And those two things coming together, the factions within the club struggling for control or struggling for recognition, and the fact that the membership was starting to wane, and it wasn't really the revenue generating engine we hoped it would be. We needed something else, something very different.
Yeah, and I think in a sense it points to that broader question of, you're operating in a highly, even at the level that rugby league's played at, you're operating in a very commercial environment with lots of commercial pressures. And sometimes that means that cooperatives and communal organisations can't compete, and that puts the club or the institution at jeopardy, doesn't it?
It does.
Just finally, because we've run over for both of you, how do you see the future of the club? I mean, let's leave aside COVID for the time being, because who knows. But all things being equal, are you optimistic after 150 years?
For me, I'm an eternal optimist, you know. And somebody asked me if I thought we would do this year, and you know, we're going to win the league, you know, type of thing. It is because we're approaching the horizon, or, you know, the crest of the hill, but we can't see what's on the other side. It's a you know, really difficult question to answer. You know, I am optimistic. The sport needs a new vigor, a new reinvention almost. You know, in terms of Hornets as a club, I still think there's an element where we could look at some supporter involvement, sort of the Bundesliga model. I think could be the something that could take Hornets forward again. You know, on an accelerated path. But yeah, it's you know, what's going to be tomorrow, and what will successful look like? So yeah, it's a challenging time, I think.
From my point of view, the future hinges on two things that Hornets have been really good at in their past: good recruitment and innovative coaching. Because I think now that the funding's been cut severely in League One, those two things are really, really important. Where do you get good players from that aren't going to cost you a fortune? And how can you get a coach who can get 10% more out of what they're capable of achieving? Because all the clubs in that division are of a similar standard. They're all in the same boat in relation to funding to a greater or lesser degree. So it's about how do you find those slivers of advantage in players to enable you to be that little bit better than everybody else. So recruitment and coaching, I think, is where the future lies for me.
And I think that's probably the secret of success for any club at any level as well, isn't it? It's a great maxim to go forward. So thanks very much, Jim and Mark. It's been a really interesting interview from the point of view of rugby history and rugby politics and just how clubs are run. To remind listeners, the book is called Triumph and Disaster, 150 Years of Rochdale Hornets by Jim Stringer and Mark Wynne, and it's published by London League Publications. You can find a link to buy the book on my webpage. On Twitter, you can follow Jim at TLCR80Mins, and Mark is on at Mark2Wynne. And as I'm sure you know, my Twitter handle is at CollinsTony, and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find a complete archive of the episodes about the history of rugby and the other football codes, plus the show notes for this episode. So, until next time, thanks for listening.